This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, you're tuned into The Property Show on The Morning Run. It's our weekly take on all things property related. I'm Sim Wee Boon. What roles do cities play in human society? How do you even plan and build a city properly? And what has the COVID-19 pandemic revealed in terms of urban planning and the modern concept of what a city means to us? We're going to try to explore these topics today with Professor Sanford Ikeda, the Professor of Economics at Purchase College of the State University of New York, who specializes in the economy of cities. Welcome to the show, Professor.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So I want to start off with the pandemic, which is pretty much the topic of the moment right now. What has the COVID-19 pandemic revealed about modern urban planning, and especially in terms of the flaws that the cities today have?
I think the first thing to appreciate is that a pandemic is something that doesn't happen very often. And so it's hard to prepare for. And there are different kinds of emergencies. It could be flooding, hurricanes that are a little bit more common, but a pandemic is kind of sui generis and has certain unique problems to it. And I suppose one of the things that we discover is how poorly most countries, the governments of most countries, although not all, moved to, first of all, recognize the problem. And then secondly, to sort of devise an effective strategy. Now, to be fair, of course, this is something that is almost unprecedented. And so one can certainly forgive mistakes made along the way. But the point is that you have to engage in policymaking with the understanding that you are going to make mistakes, that what you're doing now is based on imperfect information, based on imperfect models, whatever you may have. And so the policies that you implement must take that into account. And the practical implication is that you have to be able to think on your feet and to adjust quickly. And that's something that a lot of governments, and I can speak to the United States, at least from my perspective, I think did a poor job of just sort of in terms of addressing the pandemic. And then in terms of urban planning, you know, there's not much I think you can do beforehand. Again, because you don't know what's going to be coming. You plan for a flood very differently for the most part from you would from a pandemic, from any other sort of major crisis. That is something, again, where flexibility and the ability to adjust comes in. Now, and one lesson, I think, and I'm sure we'll get to this a little bit more later, is to have some humility in making these policies and to try to help people to understand, the general public, that these are preliminary movements, whether you're talking about quarantining, isolation, you're talking about physical distancing or lockdowns, and that, you know, the decisions are being made on the basis of imperfect information. And so when a change comes, you know, should we wear face masks or not? It's important to be honest, first of all. And then when you do change your policy, yes, you should wear masks, you know, when it turns out that they're a good idea. Well, then people won't say, you know, that, well, you lied to us. You said that it wasn't going to be necessary. So I think that the starting point has to be some humility and willingness to admit that you're coming from a place of imperfect information, and you also need to be transparent. Extremely difficult for governments to do.
How do we approach the difference in densities then? There are big cities and small towns. The ability to react to, say, a pandemic is varied in terms of how much control you can have.
I think there are two aspects to look at here. One is the physical aspect, the physical infrastructure. And then the second is you might call the invisible social infrastructure, including the rules that people live by, both formal and informal. a big city like New York, or indeed Kuala Lumpur, is very, as you say, different from a smaller town. And I think what that means is, well, take, for example, the United States. I think one thing the federal government of the United States did that I think is correct, from, in my opinion, is to leave it to the individual states to decide how to address the problem. Because, you know, Wyoming has one person per square mile, and, you know, New York City it has many, many times that. And so this kind of decentralized decision making in this situation, I think, can be and has been very helpful, because you're learning from different experiments in different areas and how it's being addressed. And we can look at how countries such as Japan or Germany or Sweden or South Korea have addressed these problems and learned from them going forward. But in terms of the physical infrastructure, yeah, I think what we see in New York City, which has a large and extensive mass transit system, is that people, shied away from them, either because they were afraid or because they didn't need them. 40% of businesses were shut down by mandate. And so the amount of travel plummeted to just a fraction, something like, I don't know, 1/10 of what it was a year ago at the same time. So it you know, you need to be able to address that situation in a big city, which in a smaller city probably wouldn't be so significant. But I think that also, you know, so the big city has those problems, but it also has, because they have a lot of people, and because it is fairly decentralized at the both the district level and neighborhood level, a lot of people finding solutions to their problems. So let me just give you one simple example. In the early days of the pandemic, hospitals were overwhelmed, particularly in the emergency rooms and the intensive care units. Staff, medical staff, the support staff were working very, very hard and long hours. Local businesses, bakeries, shops, restaurants were really hurting. And so what happened, at least in my neighborhood and neighborhoods across New York City, and I'm sure this happened elsewhere too, is that people got together on social media and said, hey, let's donate through this, whatever channels you happen to use. And we will go and we'll buy pastries, we'll buy sandwiches, we'll buy food, and we'll take it over to our neighborhood medical center or hospital or whoever happens to need it. And this was happening all over. And that was just one example of the kinds of things that were happening. And this is something that, you know, you don't plan for on a global scale, that is to say at the level of the city, which, you know, New York City has a population of about 8.4 million, but you allow people to adjust to those situations. So it's flexibility is extremely important. I think one of the failures that we encountered was a certain rigidity, at least initially, to how to address these local problems.
The pandemic has also pretty much put a stop on economies all over the world. And, you know, financial centers in cities pretty much put to a halt. Do you think that this pandemic, the lockdowns, has changed the way we look at cities as income generators for countries, especially in terms of the tax base?
I don't think so. I mean, let's back up a little bit. The reason why cities are these income tax or these tax generators is because they are wealth producers. And you know, that wealth is reflected both in terms of its, you know, the gross domestic product of the city or the region, and that's reflected in the wages and the property values of the region. And so I don't see that changing. I'm not sure. I mean, many 100 years ago in the United States, one of the principal sources of income for the federal government were tariffs, taxes on imports. This was after the passage of the Income Tax Act in 1913, 1914 in the United States. That slowly started to change until other sources of tax revenue were generated. So, I mean, income taxes, where is most of the income being created everywhere, but primarily in dynamic growing cities. I don't see that changing. I don't think it has to change, frankly. I think that I'm of the opinion that despite this pandemic, and maybe we can talk a bit about that later, it's going to remain that way. That cities will be the principal incubator of ideas, that cities will be generators of wealth and creativity going forward.
And we're going to go in for a little break right now. So don't go anywhere. Stay tuned after these messages. BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're tuned in to The Property Show on The Morning Run. I'm Sim Wee Boon. And with me today is Professor Sanford Ikeda, Professor of Economics at Purchase College of the State University of New York, who specializes in the economy of cities. Earlier in the show, we've been talking about how the pandemic has affected our view on cities and how it has changed our approach towards urban planning. Now, Professor, how has the pandemic affected our approach towards the density of the city and, you know, amenities like public transportation?
First, one thing I do want to make clear is that density is not the problem, right? Because, take Tokyo, for example, which had very low death rate and very low COVID rates. It's much denser than New York City, and New York City has among the highest both infection, fatality, hospitalization rates. And so density per se, and what do we mean by that? Well, we can define it as a number of people per hectare. Again, in that sense, Tokyo is much denser than the United States. What the problem seems to be, and one of them, I shouldn't say the problem, but one of the problems, is crowding into both private and public spaces. And in other words, you can have one of the densest portions of New York City is the Upper East Side of New York, which has high rises. And so you have many residential units stacked one on top of the other, up and down Park Avenue, up and down Madison Avenue, all along the Upper East Side, which most of you probably know is the wealthiest part of New York City. And it has one of the lowest infection rates in the entire city. Now, part of that is due to people there are rich enough to move out to their summer homes during this pandemic. But even accounting for that, it is very, very unaffected, relatively speaking, person per person. But it's dense. And so, whereas places in the Bronx that are poor and that are mainly Black and Hispanic suffered very, very badly, not just the Bronx, other places too, and parts of Canarsie, Brooklyn, I think, is a good example, small district which was severely harmed on a person-to-person basis. So you have a lot of people, five people living in an apartment, six people living in an apartment. One of them has to go to work. Maybe they work in a restaurant or something, and so they're exposed, and they come back and they can expose others. I think that's one problem that has occurred. So it's not density per se. It's overcrowding. And that's a function of income. That's a function of wealth and prosperity. So, one of the best things that can be done to address a pandemic or a flood or any kind of major catastrophe is to help people prepare by being themselves wealthier, right? Enable them to afford more space to live in and to live a decent life just in general.
How then should we approach the establishment of new cities then?
National governments around the world have from time to time experimented with establishing new cities, famously Brasilia. I know that Indonesia is considering changing its capital, moving its capital because of climactic and maybe environmental problems. I'm very skeptical of the ability to create a city from nothing, because it's hard enough to start a business, an individual business, which will attract people and will be successful. Now, a city is not a business, right? Although it is, that is an important part of a city. But my point is that in order for a city to be successful, people have to want to live there, okay? And it has to be a place that's livable, that you can find work, and you can find affordable places to live, that's an interesting place to live, right? That has you know, a diversity of opportunities for you, because people will probably, if it's successful, be coming from different parts of the country, different parts of the world to be successful. New York City, for example, almost half of the people who live here were born in a different country. And so that's the kind of attraction it has to have. And I've never seen that done historically successfully as a result of conscious planning. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't do something today that can lead to a successful city in the future. But I think what it does mean is that you cannot be, and this harkens back to something I said a little bit earlier, you can't be too rigid and specific about what you want. If you can specify exactly what you want and imagine exactly what the city is going to be, then what you are imagining, what you're specifying, is not a city at all. Because a city is not Disneyland. A city is something that is organic and that does things that is unpredictable. A lot of that is desirable. Much of it is not, because you're experimenting. People are trying different things, and there's failure, and there's mess. There's smells. Destruction. Oftentimes, there's conflict. But you know, these things to a certain point are unavoidable, and it's important for the authorities to keep, you know, the public spaces safe, to try to foster a sense of security and trust amongst people. And, you know, and I think that's a very important thing that governance has to do, right? Has to be able to establish security, not heavy-handed security, but security such that people are free to move about in public spaces, to informally make contacts and to try different things and not be prevented by rules that are inappropriate and too rigid in order to allow that to occur. I think that's you know, something that you'll always have to keep in mind. And one of the problems I can see that issue from the pandemic is a sense of wariness amongst people in public spaces today. They don't want to catch the virus. They don't approach people. I mean, they're told not to get too close to other people. You can't have physical contact. And you know, Western cultures in New York, that's kind of important. You know, it's going to have, I think, a negative effect. Physical distancing will have a negative effect the longer it persists.
Okay, then last question. Another issue I want to touch on is how people outgrow the cities that they live in. How do we avoid this, or is this inevitable?
Right. I myself, as an urbanist, don't see that as a problem. That is to say, the more people you have in a city, that means the more ideas, the greater chance of serendipity, the greater the chance of creativity and interactions and opportunities. You know, people attract people. And to sort of say, okay, this many people, no more, right, is, I think, a terrible mistake. Whether you're talking about a city, whether you're talking about a nation, closing borders of the city, closing borders of the nation, is a tragedy. Both not even talking about human rights, which I think is relevant, but you know, putting that aside, it's a tragedy in economic terms because of the talents that people bring. You may, you know, just having a different background from other people is itself a resource that can be drawn on. If you move from one city to another, even within the same country, if you move from one job to another, you realize this right away that, oh, well, the way I used to do it, that you know, job A is different from where they do it. Way they do in job B, and maybe some of those things can be brought over to the benefit of people in your new job. It's the same way in cities. So limiting artificially the population, I think, is a big mistake. And so what urban planners need to do, and I learned this lesson from the great urban planner Alain Berthaud, who was a World Bank director of planning at the World Bank, is that, you know, that's a variable you can't control. So what urban planners have to do is to look at things like low-cost mobility, whether that's mass transit or allowing micro transport or enabling different forms of transport to emerge that may not have been foreseen. And also, so mobility in order so that people can get to jobs quickly and at low cost, or to move from one job to another at low cost and very quickly. And also housing affordability, of course, that's very, very important. Allow people to afford space, even if it's very small, so that they can move from one place to another and become successful that way. This goes back to the theme of you can't predict what a city is going to do. And in order to govern successfully, you really have to be flexible and humble, in the sense that you don't know all the answers and need to be able to adjust as quickly as you can to changing situations, which a growing population, which is a sign of success, right? Dying cities lose population, successful cities gain population. It's a sign of success, but you have to be able to accommodate it.
That's all the time we have for today's Property Show. Thank you for being in the show, Professor. That was Professor Sanford Ikeda, Professor of Economics at Purchase College of the State University of New York, who specializes in the economy of cities. If you want to hear more thoughts from Professor Ikeda, he'll be the guest of a webinar organized by the Center for Market Education and co-hosted by Provalindo Nusa from Indonesia, where they'll be exploring the topic of centrally planned cities. For more information, search up for the Center for Market Education on Facebook or the website www.marketedu.org. We've got the 10 a.m. news bulletin coming up next, followed by Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
The Property Show on BFM 89.9, the business station. Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.